Welcome back to Creative Therapy Umbrella. This is a place where we talk about all different types of creative arts therapy, expressive therapies, and creative approaches to therapy. Before we start today, I just want to send out as many positive thoughts as I can to everybody listening and everybody around the world during this really difficult transitional time. I hope that everybody is able to move through the changes, the expectations, the different routines, and I hope that everybody's also staying really healthy and able to do the things that they need to support themselves and others. On today's episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Amber Gray, who, among many other things, is an award-winning dance movement therapist. She is the executive director of the Kint Institute, and she also has her own business, Restorative Resources. She shares so many different things today on this episode, talks about the training program for creative arts therapists, a training program at Kint Institute that specializes in trauma. And the thing that's so cool about this is it integrates all creative arts therapists together, which I love. But she also does discuss all of her clinical experiences. And I'd just like to say up front that, you know, we do talk about trauma a lot in this podcast, and this episode is no different. But I just like to give that warning up front in case anybody is not in the space to talk or hear about trauma. This episode does contain discussions of trauma work in natural disasters, torture, and other different types of social trauma. So remember to take care of yourself, give yourself space, and enjoy the episode. Okay, Amber, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, Kate.
Thanks for making the time to be here and talk with us today.
I'm happy we found a time because it's been a long time trying to sort it out.
Yes, yeah. Things come up and it's funny because we're recording this during the kind of beginnings of coronavirus too. So now it's like, I feel like everybody's schedules are going to turn into something completely different as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Like no schedule. Yeah. I've had people say to me, I don't know how to do this.
Yep. Same. My schedule is going from like an 11 to 7 to like 9 to 5 now. It's just everything is totally different.
Yeah.
Well, tell our listeners a little bit about what you currently do.
Well, I'm the executive director of the Kint Institute. I'll just sort of say the labels first. And then I also have my own program, Restorative Resources, which provides training and consultation. So between the two of those, I do a lot of consulting and training around the world. I developed a framework, restorative movement psychotherapy and polyvagal informed dance movement therapy and somatic therapies that I teach. Right now I'm New Zealand. I'm supposed to be there in 4 weeks. That's a big question mark. And I also work with refugees and survivors of torture for 23 years. So I established the first refugee mental health program in the U.S. in New Mexico. I currently train for that program. I'm no longer in a coordination role and do a lot of consulting in that field as well. And with the Kint Institute, which is the how we connected as the executive director, I work closely with our training director, Craig Hain, who's a drama therapist. And that's a wonderful training program based in New York City for now. Thinking about expanding to other places, but it's an integrated creative arts therapies and trauma program that where we really are working not with individual creative arts therapies only, but I like to say we source the essence of what makes those therapies so magic and so powerful and so potent when working with trauma. And that's what we teach. And that's a 4-part training program. Our level one is a 4-part training program. We're starting a 3-part level two in 2021 to 2022. Yeah, we're in, no, 2020 to 2021 next year. So, yeah.
Very cool.
So yeah, I do. And I'm also a continuum teacher and a yoga teacher, a lot of movement So
yes, yes, that is awesome. There's so much to go on. I don't even know where to go because there's so many questions I want to ask you. Can you start with, well, let's start with the Kin Institute, because that's, I think, our original connection was, yes, I had heard about it, and I found it fascinating that it is an integrative program where it's all creative arts therapies, where you have, you know, you're housing not just one particular creative arts therapist. Can you tell us, you know, maybe the catalyst of the Institute, where it kind of came from and how it kind of came about?
Absolutely. It's really the vision really comes from Craig Hain, our training director, who's a drama therapist. And it was, what year was that? It was the same year as Katrina. So I'm
2005? Was it 2005?
I can't remember.
Remember I was in college.
I know that I was canvassing for one of the elections when it, I just, so I remember, yeah, I don't remember what year.
Maybe 2004 then, yeah.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I don't think it was that long ago. It was more, anyways, Craig was invited to put together a trauma day, a panel, a day-long process at the Expressive Arts Summit in New York City. And so he invited colleagues who, some who he knew well, we had not met prior to that, but we knew of each other's work. Shanice Stepikoff, Brian, who's a poetry therapist, Brian Harris, who's a music therapist, Ani Buck, who's a art therapist, and the five of us, and I hope I'm not forgetting anybody, but it was a while ago, co-created this day. And out of both our co-creation and the response to the day, we started visioning, and I would say very much with Craig's, he was really stirring the soup, so to speak. We were all active ingredients in the soup. He was stirring it. We saw a need. And so we started asking people, and we even did a survey. And then we offered a two-day event in New York City. I know that was June of 2014, because I had to fly in from Beirut. So I remember that really well. It was when right when ISIS was starting to really become very, very strong. I just have a very, you know, palpable, visceral memory of that. And we did this two-day workshop and also surveyed people afterwards and realized that, A, we all loved each other and loved working together and felt that there was a natural potency there. And B, that people wanted this work and that there was no program for all of the creative arts therapies in the very unique way that they can mix together in working with trauma. And we all are people who have extensive experience. That's our work. That's our, you know, clinical population. That's our community of clients. So we put it together and, you know, we're in our fourth cohort. We're actually having our third weekend of our fourth cohort this weekend. We've got to do it on Zoom. So, you know, crisis is often when creativity sprouts and germinates, sprouts and flourishes all at the same time. So we're having to adapt the program to an online forum fairly quickly. So that's the catalyst and a bit of the genesis of our work, our program.
That's amazing. And so cool that it came out of just something that was needed, and that, you know, the power of surveys too, of when you can ask people, you know, like get that feedback. And I think as a creative arts therapist, I feel like there is such a need for that, because we can be so separated, and there's just not a place where we can experience each other being so grounded in the arts.
Yeah. And what we do that I think is quite unique is, you know, my weekend, which is the first weekend, isn't just on dance therapy. It's on embodiment. You know, Brian teaches on voice. He's a music therapist. Ani teaches on symbols, you know, and images and the rich tapestries, you know, of, you know, as components of art therapy. We've now got, Shanice still works with us, but we've also got Heidi Landis and Nancy Sherlong, who's a poetry therapist.
Ooh, cool.
Heidi Landis is a drama therapist. Shanice is going to be part of our advanced course now, but they do metaphor, working with metaphor, symbols, all of that in the fourth weekend. So, and drama and poetry sort of integrate together for that weekend. And then I also bookmark our training with self-care, which is really important, you know, the beginning and the end. It's the Ouroboros, the eternal spiral. It's one of the most important things that we all do, right? I always say it's our most important clinical skill is to be able to tend to ourselves.
Yep.
And so we really source, you know, the things that are potent about each of these creative arts therapies. And we do work together a lot. I mean, there's a lot of cross-referencing, cross-fertilization.
Yes. It's so awesome to just imagine the creativity that must come out of those spaces where you have people who are so creative and then dabbling in different mediums or modalities and getting inspired by each other of all of the things that must come out of that space.
Yeah, it is. It's wonderful. It's really wonderful. And we really build community with the cohort. It's a very intentional, I mean, that's an intentional quality of our program, is that we build community, that we build the cohort. So it's a cohort program.
Mm-hmm. And the program, it specifically focuses on trauma, on those modalities and trauma specifically, correct?
Those modalities with trauma and how those modalities use voice, embodiment, symbol, image, metaphor, all of that. And, you know, we don't necessarily, I mean, we assign certain elements to each weekend, but we all work with it.
Yeah, that fully like integrated model where it's like, everybody's in on it.
Everybody's in on it. And then we also weave trauma theory through it. So Craig teaches the trauma theory, three solid, you know, blocks over the four weekends of very current trauma theory. And we always have a guest speaker.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's awesome too. The guest speaker. Yeah. Oh my goodness. There's so many great people. I feel like that could, you know, not only take that and benefit from it, but then, you know, bring back different things. And that's so cool. And so for, if listeners, I will link to that too. So if any listeners are interested in learning more about it, I can put that, in the show notes. Currently, is it a, is it something you can do remote or is it only in person?
It's in person.
In person.
And, you know, we're mostly catering to the East Coast now. We have had people fly out from the West Coast and other places, even from Germany 1 year. But we would like to expand it. I mean, as executive director, I'm a real fan of slow growth. We have so many ideas and, you know, countries we want to work in, and slow growth, because otherwise it can get really crazy.
Yes.
I'm the only one who doesn't live in the East Coast. I live in Santa Fe, and that to me is a natural second location for this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, that could be soon. We're starting the part two or the second year, which is the more advanced work, which incorporates a lot of great supervision, and that will start in the next year. And then I think after we've run that a few years, we'll be looking at perhaps having a Southwest Western cohort.
Yes, I know. That would be very exciting because I'm in Denver. So so much easier to get to than New York. Yes, I'm originally from New York, but that's awesome. That's great. And I think too, like, it seems like something that couldn't be done just online, you know, the intensity of a program like that, there's got to be those in-person elements to that.
I think so. I mean, I think there is, I'm sort of observing a camp that's evolving, you know, all of a sudden there's an explosion of online embodiment, conscious dance. And I hope we're careful. You know, I hope we're really careful as human beings. One of my teachers in the field of continuum, or the world of continuum, Emily Conrad, coined the term, you know, the biohuman, it was a term she used a lot, and biointelligence. And there's a reason, you know, just in terms of the evolution of the species and the evolution of the world, that we are in bodies. And we don't always know what that reason is, but we are. And I always say, you know, our bodies courageously show up to house our spirits, you know, a dwelling place for however long we're here. So I do think the essential work is done in person, mm-hmm. body to body, brain to brain, nervous system to nervous system, heart to heart. I think things can be done online, and I think a lot is lost. And you know, I'll just name that as I watch, you know, going from the bushfires, and I mean, since the new year, I've been in Haiti where there's tremendous violence, and then I was in Australia where the bushfires, I think, issued a fair warning to all of us about how deeply we're in climate crisis, and now, you know, COVID-19, the coronavirus, and I always step back and go, what are the opportunities here? You know, what's really going on? And I think now we're recognizing the power of virtual connecting, because it is keeping us together through social distancing, and also the limits, you know. And I think there's something about locality and the body, and how if we really tend to our bodies and, you know, as creative, as the source of our creativity, we're also tending to the earth, and we're tending to each other. And mm-hmm. that gets lost online. I mean, you know, I can see you.
Right.
And you're in a flat screen, you know, I mean, you're not as two-dimensional.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes. So. And like when you said, even nervous system, brain to brain, nervous system to nervous system, like that is so, even with doing these interviews, I love doing the video, even though I only use the audio, but it's one more component that makes it a little bit nicer to have that, you know, share that. But there is so much that's not there, that like you just can't feel the tension in the room if there's tension in the room, or, you know, there's so many elements that happen when you're sharing a space that are so lost, even just in talking, let alone when you're in a therapeutic space.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
Yeah. It's interesting because we're currently moving. I think a lot of people are moving to telehealth. My current work is in that move. And I did my first telehealth session today, and I was like, it worked, but it just isn't, it's not the same. There's so much limit to it, but I hope that maybe we learn a lot from that. Like you were saying, like we learn mm-hmm. the limits of that, and maybe can spend more time like in our bodies of like, wow, I'm feeling these really different things.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I hope we miss each other enough that we, you know, maybe that's going to be the invitation in what we're having to do now with social distancing. If we begin to miss each other, I already miss, I miss people who I can't go visit for various reasons. And, you know, I keep saying, may we learn the power of human connection, and how, you know, biointelligent that is, that we really are meant to shape and breathe and move together.
Yes.
Create, draw, play. It's just so powerful.
Yeah. Just
breathe. I'm sad that we're doing our weekend online. We had to preserve the weekend. We had to preserve the flow of the course. You know, so I know some richness will be lost. I also, it's, you know, Ani's absolutely brilliant. And, you know, we're creative arts therapists, and we're all really experienced. And so we're gonna make it work.
Yes. Yes.
We're gonna make it play. It's gonna be a playful experiment.
Yes. And I think in these times, that's kind of what we have to do. And then cool things come out of that too, of when you're forced to create, and you know what comes out of it. So that's awesome. Now, besides the Kin Institute, which sounds absolutely amazing, Restorative Resources, that's your kind of your brainchild specifically, right?
It's actually my LLC. It's my business. And and it's I had to create one to sort of house what I do as I moved from early in my work as a dance movement therapist and in somatic psychology. I was working in an agency and working with torture treatment and refugee mental health. And as I shifted into more and more consulting and training and developing my own training program, which I teach through Restorative Resources, I just needed a house. I needed a house mm-hmm. for it, and a name and all that logistical stuff. So
yes,
that's what that is.
With that, because you said that, you know, you've spent so much time doing treatment for torture survivors, as you were experiencing that and as you were, you know, doing that work early on, what was that like for you when there wasn't, you know, that many resources, or if there were any resources? Or what was that like?
Well, it was a new landscape. It was a brand new landscape, and I like new landscapes. I'm actually, my temperament and personality is I'm one of those people, I'm a catalyst, and I like new landscapes, and I've heard that the word pioneering is no longer okay to use, but pioneering, like, or word. Exploring or innovating. I like that. I do better if you throw me in the chaos and I have to work it out. And then if it gets really organized and everything's functioning, then I look for something new. So it was very intentional. I was in a shift in my work career. I was in public health, and then I got into actually doing some body work for a while and studying traditional medicine and things like that. And I was considering everything from medical school to acupuncture to psychology, and then I was looking at dance movement therapy because I'm a dancer, and dance is where I go. It's my go-to, it's my healing, it's my source, it's my prayer, it's my joy. And I was working in the public health field in Rwanda shortly after the genocide, and had this extraordinary moment, which I've probably shared in other interviews, but of being the first on the scene after a grueling drive and checkpoints and trying to streamline the jeepy, I'm speaking Australian, the jeepy, the jeep, the land cruiser, through, you know, a tiny swath of land, where there were no landmines, and being first to arrive to a community where most of the adults were dead, were killed in the massacre, and there was a pretty large group of children. I'm remembering about 20, and my interpreter and I got out of the car and or the Land Cruiser, and they welcomed us with what they could find. They had a few old instruments around, and they had some tin cans and stuff, and they did a little welcome song and dance. And I just had this extremely powerful but extremely naive moment of, oh, I'm going to go to school for dance therapy. That's what I'm going to do. And, you know, a lot has been written about Rwanda and them saying, you know, all these psychiatrists came in, but this is what we do. We dance. And I went to school, and my internship was at a very small program where I ended up becoming the clinical director and really growing the torture treatment program in the early days of funding. There's a small group of colleagues and I who really, I think, nurtured that field and created the field. And I was definitely the only dance therapist, and I was the only non-stringent medical model. So there was a lot of pushback. Yeah. You might hurt clients, you know. And I will say that I learned a lot. What I teach in my own training program is how I've adapted working with the body, which is where we have to work with trauma, especially interpersonal trauma on the level of torture or domestic violence or child abuse. And I learned through a lot of mistakes how to adapt it. And that's, so that's what came out of that really wild, you know, sort of wild, untethered boat in the ocean experience that I started in.
How it's such a climactic experience, even just hearing the beginning of how it was kind of like this totally open, untraversed, you know, adventure. And then it came, and, you know, like, then even bringing it to a program of, like, then it kind of ended up and you had this program that you helped, you know, facilitate and nurture, like you said, that it ended in something like that. Such growth throughout that.
Well, it was interesting because the program that I ran as a clinical director is the Rocky Mountain Survivor Center. They're not there. I had case managers, social workers, so clinical psychologists, and I had 3 or 4 dance therapists at all times. And it wasn't just because I was a dance movement therapist. I saw how helpful it was. I saw how helpful it was. And you know, we were a growing agency, so we were just starting to do some research before I left. But what I observed sort of anecdotally is that clients tended to find ground faster. I mean, we were grant funded, so we didn't have to be on timelines. We could work with clients as long as they needed. We could do long sessions, which, yeah, so luxurious to think about. Yes. I mean, now, because I'm working with managed care, but people tended to find ground and they tended to stabilize quicker and they tended to engage more quickly. So, and that's what started all the questions in my mind about what's going on here. And I just started noting, you know, what I was doing and what I was seeing. I befriended Stephen Porges late 90s, early 2000 at a conference. I listened to him speak and had this moment of, oh my God, he was talking about autism. And I was like, oh my gosh, the face of terror. And asked a question and he asked me to, you know, meet him during a break. And that started a long-term friendship and collegial sort of, I call it a collaboration, idea sharing that really developed polyvagal-informed somatic and movement therapies, which are very much, it's very much for working with trauma, but it's interesting. I mean, the framework that I teach is informed by that and by working with refugees and survivors. So I used to present it as refugee survivor specific. I've learned that it's actually one of my students said, you're teaching trauma-informed dance movement therapy. You're mm-hmm. teaching polyvagal-informed dance movement therapy. Mm-hmm. And it applies to all trauma, but it's particularly nuanced for the intense interpersonal complex trauma and the variety of cultures that I've worked with.
Yeah.
Had to make a lot of adaptations. And I, you know, my quest was really, I didn't intend to create anything. What helps? What's helpful if I'm in Darfur or I'm in Beirut or I'm in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, you know, and there's gunfighting or there's earthquake shaking, you know, what helps in these different contexts? So it's really just an unfolding question that became
a thing.
Framework and, yeah. and an actual clinical approach. Yeah. And, you know, and I don't own it. I always say it's a reflection of my client's courage. That's what it is.
Oh, that's so beautiful. I love that.
What it is.
Yes. Yeah. And for, you know, as you did that personally, and there's, you know, I think a lot of us as creative arts therapists can get into a place where there's pushback or, you know, there's not enough evidence or whatever, you're kind of getting these things coming. What was something that was like a driving force for you that like you, okay, like I see this change and I see that this is working. How did you keep that momentum going for, you know, and maybe that's even a self-care question, but.
Yeah. Well, I think, one thing that I just thought of something my dad just told me. I had to interview him when I was in school for somatic psychology and dance movement therapy about my birth. It was for one of my classes. And the first thing he said, and I don't remember what the question was, he said, you were born dancing and fighting and you've never stopped either. And he said, you were an activist before you could walk in many ways. And so I think there's that spirit, of that. I witnessed some things living in Guatemala in the 80s and in other countries where there was conflict and violence. I actually witnessed torture. I, you know, stumbled upon it once and, you know, waking up in the morning where there are dead bodies in ditches. And I think that lit a human rights flame. I mean, mm-hmm. I often call myself a human rights psychotherapist. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, how I said it early on was the body is home and everybody has a right to go home or to be home. As I said, there was some naivete. I made a lot of mistakes. I'm a very expressive person. I was deeply wanted, you know, profoundly loved in my upbringing and had a lot of space for creativity and expression. And that's one of the things that trauma robs us of, right? It's different relationship to space. Space can be scary, expression can be very, very vulnerable. So I think it was my commitment to human rights. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I say all the time is every human being has the right to inhabit their body in the way they choose. And many people don't get to live that right. So it was that fire. And then my clients' responses, even when it was hard, a lot of people ask me, well, isn't it hard to work with people, you know, you don't speak their language all over the world? I had a lot of enthusiastic, willing clients. I mean, and I've been reflecting over the years on all the clients and just how willing they were. And so if they're willing and if they keep coming back to the sessions and, you know, whether we focused on breathing or focused on sensation in the body, or we're really up and moving and dancing or working with metaphor in movement or a little bit of drawing. I watched those, I like to call them the shimmers and the glimmers, you know, that would come back in their eyes, the little sparks, and watch the light come back and watch them sit up more straight and watch their shoulders drop back and watch the stir, you know, and just empowerment. So a lot of what I realized is that even though I was working sometimes with depression or post-traumatic stress disorder, I always say my ultimate clinical outcome is belonging. And my refugee clients taught me that. One day I realized that the essence of displacement and loss for refugees and survivors, not all refugees have been tortured, many of them have, but the essence of that is a loss of place and belonging. So my framework looks at belonging as the core of what we're working with. And that also, I would say, drove me in a very humanitarian way, that this fierce belief that everybody belongs.
Yes.
And yeah. And coming from international relations when I was in college and, you know, social justice, that term was popular then it kind of got quiet, but I think it was really a social justice approach.
That's amazing. And that idea that, you know, your body is home, but for some people it's not, and that, you know, working to get back to that. And that is such a social justice that we all deserve that as human beings. It's a human right to have that. And finding that way to get there. And then I think too, when you're, you know, like you were saying, you're on the other side of it, you know what it's like to feel home and that you want that, you know, that it's wanting to help other people get there and find their way.
Absolutely. Well, I remember one of my teachers once saying to me, she was talking about the work she did. It's actually Emily Conrad who originated Continuum, which is a powerful, probably one of the most embodied practices I know. And we were talking about trauma and she was talking about, she was recognizing what she called my gift working with it and the challenges in it. And I said, you know, many of us are seeking refuge, really. The speed of life right now, technology, again, grateful that it's here now in this particular whatever this is that we're in, but the speed and demand that it puts on a body that's mostly composed of carbon, like the stars that, you know, I've worked with, and I have friends and teachers who are Aborigines who talk about coming from the stars and rising from the earth. And, you know, just the recognition that many of us, whether it's chronic pain, chronic illness, terminal illness, fear, terror, trauma, mental health conditions, we're seeking refuge. And that's where we know and own it, is the body. It's the body. And I had another client, I remember a client who once said to me, you know, sometimes my body's a beautiful garden and sometimes it's a minefield. And the hard part is that I never know what it's going to be if I start to go. She was kind of cautioning me. She was one of the clients early on who I was enthusiastic, you know, let's go. And she said that to me. And I remember sitting back and going, oh my goodness. Wow. You know, and those were the kind of, I mean, my clients, it was, they cued the path to me for sure. Mm-hmm.
Just taking, it's like synthesizing all of those little things of like, and I feel like that's such a, wow, like what a moment for a client to you know, for it's like a, whoa, that's a whole nother thing to really think about and sit on.
Yeah.
Wow. That's phenomenal. Especially with, I think the, even kind of where we are now, but there seems to be, it seems to be like we're getting farther away from our bodies than we are getting into them. And, you know, having that harder time of getting into them, especially mental health, any kind of stuff. It's, you know, everything's going so fast and it's so easy to disconnect from your body.
Very easy.
Mm-hmm.
Fear makes it easier. Terror makes it even easier. Stress makes it, you know, easy. And I would say it's the demand of life. I call it the exteroceptive bombardment. You know, it used to be the sound of birds and the wind, and then it was the sound of industrialization, right? You know, building things and creating houses, and then suddenly machines, and then, you know, cars and airplanes. And now it's not even audible, but it's there. You know, the waves, the microwaves, whatever the waves are that come out of computers.
And they're so quiet. Like they're, I feel like I can hear it. Like if a TV gets turned on, it's like crazy high pitched, but it's like something's on. Like I can hear it, but I can't hear it, but I know it's there.
Yeah.
We're taking it all in too. It totally, you know, we're taking so much. And that's something, I know you mentioned autism before. I work with a lot of children who are on the spectrum, and it's interesting to think of all of those different things that we're taking in. Our brain is synthesizing, and then our bodies are trying to work through too of everything that's coming in. And then imagining that with somebody who's neurodivergent in some way. And then what does that, you know, what does that look like for them and how different that can be?
Yeah. I have not worked with autism. I mean, my work has all been in the context of war and torture related trauma, and also domestic violence, trafficking, things like that. But I think there's a similar, you know, the stimulus, you know, the overstimulus. Yes. And
and the more that I read about trauma in, you know, trauma in different populations, there seems to be connections in some, especially when it's body related. Like, I feel like when there's, if it's mental health, or if it's, you know, children who are, you know, have developmental differences, the embodiment piece still comes up and seems to be this big thing. I think we're starting to get on it a little bit more of, you know, regulating the body and you know, what all of that means. And for children on the spectrum, if it's, you know, hand flapping or something, but really trying to understand the body and how it works in all of those pieces. And I think trauma is kind of leading that work, and trauma is leading that for sure.
I think so. You know, it's interesting. I remember I was presenting with a colleague of mine who's a brilliant clinical psychologist, Dr. Andrea Northwood. She's at the Center for Victims of Torture in Minneapolis. And we were teaching together. It was at a conference in Berlin. It was a conference focused on torture, the IRCT, International Rehabilitation Council. And one of the participants, after we were finished with our presentation, he said, well, you know, was talking about Dancer. He says, well, where's, you know, is this evidence-based? And I can be a little bit of a smart aleck, and I just stood up and I went, it's right here. And I just said, I'm going to ask you all, where would you be without your bodies? How do you read the evidence? How do you quantify the evidence? How do we, you know, like, we tend to get into this kind of abstract seeming quantifiable mental space that emerges from the deep loam of the human body, right? I mean, it's fertile ground in there, and it's the synthesis of sensation and emotion and thought and perception. It's all of that. So,
yes.
So I still use that. Like, here we are. Like,
well, we're living proof by just walking.
And yes.
I think that's always, and especially for us as creative arts therapists, there's the constant struggle of, is it evidence-based? And even it's, you know, everything wasn't evidence-based at some point. And that doesn't mean it doesn't work. You know, like everything wasn't evidence-based. So it seems
I love that. Oh, sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead.
I love that concept of practice-based evidence. I don't know who originated it. I'd actually love to know, but you know, like what does our practice teach us? And you know, when I hear practice, I mean, a lot of people focus on clinical practice. I also pay attention to what does my practice teach me? What does my practice of trying to sit and meditate? What is my practice of making sure I move every day and don't get glued to the computer, especially now. I mean, the last 4 days I've spent so much computer time out of necessity because everything is reorganizing, but you know, all the practices that we're engaged in, how, you know, our daily practice of cooking a meal, you know, did I even know that I just cut up a pepper? Did I really smell that teriyaki sauce? I mean, just right. What are our practices? So I, you know, practice-based evidence. How do we know things? We know through our body. Mm-hmm. Our senses are the first informant, right? We smell, we see, and then we layer things onto it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a creative process.
Yes. And as creative arts therapists too, that the importance of being with your practice, you know, of your art, your whatever you practice, like I feel like is so grounding in that thought of bringing it back to your body, you know, of like, yes. I think of even playing music and it's like you play something and, you know, you get the like, whoa, kind of feeling, whatever if you're playing with a group or you're playing by yourself and you finally get something, but it's the feeling that comes first, not the like, oh, I just, you know, did a C sharp run, or, you know, you're not like, you know, conceptualizing it into something else. And how important that is for creative arts therapists too, to stay with that practice.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Know what we love and keep doing it. Why did we become an art therapist or a drama therapist or a poetry therapist or a dance therapist or a music therapist? Why?
Yes. That we need to stay connected.
Yeah.
So, and because of, you know, all of the work that you have done in such incredibly difficult work that it is, for all of the creative arts therapists listening, whether they're in similar work or, you know, something else, what would you tell them about self-care? What's something that you would say is necessary about self-care?
I say this all the time. It's a moral and ethical obligation. I learned through, actually, Rwanda was my first experience. About 2 weeks after I came home, my back seized up. I'd never had any back issues. Like the muscles seized up and I couldn't trace it. And it was very interesting because I was trying to get groceries up to a condo and I had an elevator. And I mean, I'd been at a friend's house and she had to like literally stuff me in my car and I had to, you know, drive home like this. And it was at a time where I was actually at that time a body worker and I snowboarded all the time and mountain biked. And so I was moved a lot. And I was like, this doesn't make sense. And I remember calling, you know, my chiropractor, I needed to see him. And he was like, that doesn't make sense. And my ex-boyfriend was the only person I could call in that moment. He wasn't the person I wanted to call. Then he carried the groceries up and he sat down and he looked at me and he said, your idea of taking a break is getting another latte. You just came back from a war zone. He said, that's all I know. Because we hadn't talked a lot. He said, I'm just going to invite you to reflect on that. And, you know, and I was like, ooh. That was very potent. Mm-hmm. And then I went into working with survivors of torture, and from there went and lived in Haiti for a while. After I left the Rocky Mountain Survivor Center, I set up a program for victims of torture in organized violence in Port-au-Prince. And I was also working on a project with some colleagues and one of my dears, Dr. Sandra Bloom, amazing woman. I remember we were working this project together and I got to New York and she, after about a half day, she goes, I don't know if you have PTSD. She goes, but I can see the effects of living in violence on you. She goes, you need to do something. And I was like, no, I don't, you know. And I did. I actually did. I actually was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean, I think it's you know, I think that's a useful disclosure is mm-hmm. from having lived in this very intense environment where there was constant violence and dodging bullets. And that, you know, after those two and a few other experiences, like this is really important. And I started, and then I actually had a client. It's kind of a long story. I tell it a lot in my trainings, but she booked two sessions instead of one at the end of the day. She'd known me for 4 years because I'd worked with her whole family. Mm-hmm. And she never wanted therapy. She was the mother and she held the family together. And it came to a time where she asked for therapy. Her whole family had graduated. And she called me out. And she, you know, one day basically just said, and I was like, you know, I don't know. You know, I just innocently asked, why do you do, what are we working on? You want extra time? And she said, you're going home today. And she listed all the things she'd learned about me that I loved, ravioli or pierogi or pouch foods, walking my dog. And she says, this is what you're going to go do. And she cleared it with my boss who was worried about me, but didn't have the skill to, he was more of an administrator, lovely mm-hmm. person. She sent me home and she gave me a talking to, you know, and she wow. said, and one of the things she said to me is, you're my reference point for everything that's good and beautiful in this world. If I can't look to you, I don't have anyone. Wow. And I was like, okay. It was really humbling and verging on humiliating for a moment. And after that, I just started really developing self-care, you know, programs and trainings and my own program. I mean, I was just, and what was interesting is she didn't know this, but a couple weeks before she did that, I got to my favorite dance class. And I couldn't dance. And I was looking at everybody. I was like, I had this really cynical, everybody looked stupid. I'd been in Kosovo for 3 weeks. And I, you know, I was burned out, but I couldn't even recognize it. So I'm pretty committed to self-care and to doing it for myself and moral obligation, ethical obligation. We can't, there's no way to show up mm-hmm. if we don't take care of ourselves. And I always, you know, all the theories about co-regulation, it starts with self-regulation. Yes. That's where the mastery is, right? The mastery is in our self-regulation.
Mm-hmm. If we can't self-regulate, it's a mess. There's no co-regulation. There's no modeling.
Can't pretend to do it. Can't practice it. Can't script it.
No, can't teach it. It's not like it's like a oxymoron of, you know, trying to teach when it's not there. And yeah. Wow. That's incredible. That reminds me of, and it's funny just to think of the power of what our bodies literally hold, you know, that they're physically holding. There was a few episodes ago, I had someone on who is a music therapist and she responded to the Parkland, shootings in Florida. And it was after the fact, and they had set up a creative arts therapy program and, kind of just went in and, you know, responded. And then later she had like ruptured discs and she was like, I didn't do anything, but my discs were ruptured. And they ended up saying that she kind of figured out that it was the trauma. Like I was holding it in my body.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing. It's amazing to kind of be in touch with that, especially as people who hold so much for sure.
Yeah. Yes. And the spine is often where it goes. I mean, the spine, you know, I always say, you know, thank our spine every day, right? When we went from quadruped to biped, it agreed to be weight bearing, you know, it's this, you know, it agreed to connect us to, you know, keep that, maintain the holy place between heaven and earth that we are. And it's a lot of, I think a lot of vicarious trauma, a lot of the impact of what we hear and sit with, I think it goes there.
Yeah. And I never even really thought about it until you referenced it too. And I was like, wow, I guess it is really literally the backbone of all of that stuff for sure. It's holding all of that. Yes. Yeah. That's awesome.
Backbone.
Yeah. Yeah. It holds it all together. It holds everything there. It's holding everything in place, all the nerves and everything.
Yeah.
Well, as we wrap up, I would love if you could tell our listeners who are interested in, if they're interested in learning more from you, doing the trainings that you offer, if they're interested in the Kin Institute, if you could kind of tell us where to find you, what kind of things you have coming up, and let them know more.
Great. So, my website is www.ambergray.com, and actually posted on there, I decided to offer a couple online classes. They're an hour and a half. One is this Thursday, one is Saturday, and I'm actually going to add some now. I've been asked to add a different time for Australia and New Zealand, possibly for China, called Ground in the Swirl. And I'm just going to offer what is helping me state shift, you know, and state, it'll be about our ability to shift the anxiety or the fear. Sometimes that's the place we need to be, but stay grounded. So that information is there, and all my trainings are there. And I think there's a link to I've got Facebook, Amber Gray Movement Therapies as well. And some of my individual offerings, Dancing the Wild Home is a wonderful retreat that I run every August where we swim with humpback whales and do embodied work. And that's coming up in August.
Wow. That sounds amazing.
Yeah. And then the Kin Institute, people can go to our website, which it's, if you Google Kin Institute, it comes right up. Mm-hmm. It's www.kininstitute.org. It's kininstitute.org. And sign up. And we have a place to sign up, and people will be in our mailing list. And we'll be notified of our training. So we will be, what is it now? It's March. We'll be announcing the training dates fairly soon. We've got them set for our level one for next year. And we'll be setting level two very soon. And then we'll be putting that information on there. And it has all the information about our program and our faculty. And it's a great website. Mm-hmm. And we sometimes send updates and newsletters. Neither of us, me or Kin Institute, floods inboxes because we're all committed to self-care.
Yes.
We're all committed to stepping away from the computer and taking a walk, petting a dog, drawing a, you know, painting a painting.
Yes, I love song. That. Bringing it back to the self-care always comes back to self-care. That is awesome. Well, Amber, thank you so much for taking the time and just sharing your passions and your knowledge with us.
Thank you. Thank you, Kate. Thanks for inviting us.
Absolutely.
For inviting
Kin Institute. Yes, totally.
Patience and scheduling, and take care and be well.
It was so lovely talking with Amber today, and I feel like along with what Amber talks about in this episode, especially about embodiment and what our bodies hold when it comes to emotions and how we are as humans, our mind and our body are connected together and we need to pay attention to both, I feel like that in combination with Christine's episode, episode 29, about mindfulness and remembering to breathe during times of chaos, these episodes just felt like such great reminders during a transitional period, during a period of crisis, during a period of huge medical anxiety, to remember these different things for ourselves as clinicians, for our clients, for our families, and just remembering, I think, giving that grace to ourselves and everybody else. And I hope those reminders are helpful for you as much as they've been helpful for me. I encourage you to go check out Amber's resources listed in the show notes. There's so many great places to find more information. And if you're looking to contact her, reach out. She's incredibly warm and lovely to talk with. If you're enjoying the podcast, you can support us in a couple different ways, but one of the most powerful is actually by either signing up for our newsletter and keeping up with all the other things that we do. We do a lot of different stuff, and I'll be putting out a resource this weekend about different telehealth interventions, ideas, and stuff like that that has worked for me. So that will be a resource coming out in the newsletter. And also, if you have a moment to subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes, this really, really helps other people who are looking for the resources that we're creating here. It helps us become more visible to them. So it's really just a way of reaching your arm out and growing the community of creative arts therapists or other people who are interested in the creative arts, expressive therapists, all different types of therapists. So I encourage you, if you have the time, to do one of those things, to write in and let us know what you like, if there's somebody that you want to be on, if you want to hear more of a different art form that we haven't talked about, or you want to hear more of one that we have talked about. I love hearing from our listeners, so always feel free to reach out. Again, I'm just sending positive thoughts to as many people as possible and hoping that you are all well. Take care and be creative.